Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. I'm super excited for this particular episode. It's all about film and film from around the world. I'll be speaking with Australian documentary filmmaker Paul David Williams on his film Gurumo, which is a documentary about the late Australian Aboriginal singer Gurumo. It's a very fascinating story, and it's kind of interesting because Gurumo died 3 days after the film was finished, and Paul David Williams thought that that it was never going to see the light of day due to sort of laws and cultural norms surrounding images of Indigenous people who have died. So it's a very fascinating talk, and we talk about a lot of the similarities between Canadian and Australian Indigenous culture and documentary filmmaking as a whole, and what it means to be screening at Hot Docs. And also, I speak with the curator of the Goethe Institute Toronto, Jutta Brendemühl, who talks about a very fascinating filmmaker, Christoph Schliegensief, who passed away in 2010. But they're showing three films of his next week. 120 Days of Bostrup, The German Chainsaw Massacre, and then Holding Skulls, which is a phone interview he did with another director, Alexander Klug. Schliegensief was very underground, very provocative, very political, and his films are unlike anything you'll ever see in North America, and I really, really enjoyed watching 120 Days of Bottrop, which was a quasi-remake of a Pasolini film, but also an homage to the late, great Rainer Werner Fassbinder. But first, here is my interview with Australian filmmaker Paul David Williams on his film, Gurumo.
Can I just say the Caesar is one of the nicest drinks you could possibly have?
Yeah?
Yeah.
Are they big in Australia?
No, we don't have them.
Okay.
We have Bloody Marys, but not with clamato juice.
I mean, the Caesar is basically an adaptation of the Bloody Mary, right?
Right.
Like, the Bloody Mary was a thing, and then the Caesar, some guy sort of took that and made it, and the name fits, Bloody Mary Caesar. You know, I think kind of where they were both, unruly leaders, I guess.
And you just need a Brutus or a Pontius Pilate, I don't know what they would be. A further adaptation.
Oh yeah, the Pontius, right? Or the Judas, maybe, I don't know. it's just a drink of betrayal and regret. I don't know.
How much will that be? Bagasaur.
Oh, that'll just one. You only need one drink, and it'll last a lifetime.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, let's do this.
All right.
Okay. Paul Damien Williams, hello. Welcome to Toronto.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Marriott. Welcome to Hot Docs.
It's lovely to be here.
The film Gurumo. I must confess, I was unaware of him prior to watching the trailer for your film. As an Australian, was he always someone that was prevalent in the culture? How did you first come to hear of him?
Well, he was in a very well-known band in the late 80s, early 90s, called Yothu Yindi. And they certainly travelled to Canada back in that period. But he really came to prominence in Australia in 2008 with the release of his self-titled album Gurumo, which was a real unexpected breakthrough in Australia and to a lesser extent in Europe. It went on to sell 500,000 copies, which for an Indigenous artist singing in Indigenous
language
is kind of without precedent. He really emerged onto the Australian scene with that record, and then subsequent records, and just recently, a couple of weeks ago, a posthumous record called Jaramiri.
You opened by with a note on the screen saying Australians and Torres Strait Islanders should be aware that the following contains images of people who have died. That's a very interesting way of sort of phrasing a disclaimer, and it's not one that is seen a lot. What was the and obviously Grumel has passed since the film has been made. Was that an homage to him? What was the impetus behind that specific sort of disclaimer?
Oh, okay. Well, that disclaimer is fairly common on programming in Australia that features deceased Indigenous people, because there are cultural protocols within their beliefs about showing images of the deceased or the hearing voices of the deceased. So that it's really a standard sort of card that features in a lot of films. But what happened in the case of this film is 3 days after we finished it, he passed away.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was... and with Yolngu, which is his the language tribal group that he belongs to in Northeast Arnhem Land, kind of one of the most remote parts of Australia, in the north of Australia, that they retire the name, the image, any audio recordings of a person for a set period of time that is set by the family. So we, the producer, Sharon Swan, and I fully expected the film, despite being finished, to be shelved for, who knows, 5 or 10 years. But what happened was that the family actually... mindful of his great cultural significance, have made an exception in his case. So after about 12 months, they said, okay, that's enough time. You're able to screen the film.
You've included Torres Islands in that.
Torres Strait Islands, right.
Excuse me, yes. And which is... I find it a very great decision, especially considering there is the sort of the interesting socio-political dynamic that group of islands finds themselves in right now with the independence movement and all that. Why was it important to you to include that part of Australia within the disclaimer of the film, especially considering they might go independent, they might not?
Like I was mentioning previously, it's an accepted wording of a disclaimer, really, at the start of the film. There's no real decision behind it.
You mentioned that you were able to release this film 12 months after Grumel passed, and we're at the Hot Dogs Festival in Toronto, and getting into a film festival is obviously a very good thing, but does it hold extra significance to the fact that you're at a documentary film festival?
Hmm. Well, it does to me. I'm a documentary tragic. That's how I kind of think of myself. I don't know if you have that phrase over here.
Documentary tragic?
Yeah. Like, for example, if you're a basketball tragic or an ice hockey tragic, you live and breathe, whatever team you follow, like you're a tragic for that team. Well, I'm a documentary tragic. I love documentaries. I always have. And I love documentarians. I follow their work. I follow their careers. So, yeah, it's a real thrill for me to be here, actually.
And I know you were just in France as well.
Mm.
What do you make of the whole film controversy surrounding the Cannes Film Festival over there, where they're saying they're not going to allow Netflix, for example, that hasn't screened in theaters?
Yeah, it's a good question. Look, for me personally, with this film, I'm just after the biggest audience I possibly can get, whether it's people watching it in cinemas, on Netflix, on an iPad, on a phone, however the audience comes to it, I don't really mind. Obviously, it's great. I mean, we've got cinematic distribution in Australia and Canada and a few other places, so it's really great for it to get out there. But I mean, that shouldn't be the model that that determines. I just feel, and Steven Spielberg, I mean, you know, said a similar thing: cinema for cinema, TV for TV. Well, look, I think it's kind of inevitable that these things are going to new technologies wipe out old technologies all the time, and when they're better, people don't tend to cry about it for too long.
Do you think, in terms of, you know, accessibility, getting your films out there, you know, with everything like Netflix, Hulu, and traditional cinema, does that make it easier or harder to get a film distributed, do you think?
I think if a film is good enough, it'll get distributed. If the story cuts through and it's strong enough, I think distribution tends to follow. I mean, if a story follows, you know, the great kind of archetypes of storytelling, people gonna want to watch it. I mean, it's tricky with this film because it's Australian content, specifically Australian content, but the themes then that kind of go beyond that. So we're hoping that the international distribution kind of kicks on.
I feel that Australia and Canada are actually quite similar, not only being, you know, former British territories and colonies, but also in their history of Indigenous culture. You know, Canada's been going through a process the last couple of years of, you know, reconciliation with the Indigenous peoples and sort of trying to figure out the next phase of that relationship. What's the talk, you know, between those two worlds in Australia like? Do you notice any similarities between what we're doing here and sort of what has happened or what is happening over there in a way?
Look, yes, I think there are parallels. I mean, I don't really claim to be completely across your reconciliation movement here in Canada, but I can tell you about Australia. It's a stalled process. It's a process that the Indigenous people of Australia really want to advance. They're getting organised. And there's a great deal of upswell within the European community of Australia in terms of support. For example, there was what's called a stolen generation in Australia, where there was forcible adoptions of Indigenous children in the 60s into the 70s and before. So you had all these people who didn't really know where they came from, and, you know, the terrible psychological difficulties associated with that. Now, we had a prime minister. I mean, we kind of like a revolving door of prime ministers, like four or five prime ministers ago.
Is it who is it now? Is it Turnbull or?
Turnbull is the prime minister now. Yeah, but not for long, I don't think. But Kevin Rudd was the prime minister who actually kind of advanced this cause in a big way by basically, you know, saying, giving a mea culpa and an apology. A very heartfelt apology, which really was a watershed moment. And that was in 2007, 2008, I think, when this album came out. So So when Gorham Moore's first album came out, so in a way, his music is like the soundtrack to this sort of sense of change. And I think that the film, one of the things that we've been able to do with the film is really provide, by demonstrating the relationship between Gorham Moore and his producer, Michael Honan, and manager, Mark Gross, this relationship of conflict that exists when, in the language of Northern Australia, right, when a white fella and a black fella have to walk in each other's worlds. And so the film ultimately is a parable of reconciliation.
You mentioned The Stolen Generation, and I think it was actually a film about that time period that first turned me on to Australian Indigenous cinema. Rabbit Proof Fence, I remember, that was sort of my first education into that world.
Yeah.
And what do you, you know, and they're obviously Australia's making a lot more films about Indigenous people and Indigenous issues now. What, just from an artistic and cultural perspective, what do films about the Aboriginals add to the cultural identity of Australia?
Look, that's a great question. Look, from my perspective, probably the best currently working filmmaker in Australia, a fella called Warwick Thornton, whose film Sweet Country sort of, you know, just killed him at Venice last year. You know, he's just a brilliant filmmaker.
Right.
I think that we're starting to see in the last 10 to 20 years like an emergence of actual, you know, Indigenous filmmakers who are telling their own stories. And it's a very, very welcome and kind of overdue cultural contribution to the cinematic landscape of the country. And just the perspective just is different and powerful, and look, it's really welcome. They're rocking it right now.
This film does have international distribution. What has the reception for you been like as you've traveled to a few different places to present this work?
Yeah, it looked good. It went to Berlin, and that was its international premiere there, and had two screenings with standing ovations, so that's always a good sign.
Yeah.
And back home, the critical reception to the film's been, but we couldn't. We thought we'd made a good film, but you never really know until it's out there. But I mean, it's been getting 4.5 out of 5 stars, kind of in most publications in the country, and reviewers are really kind of clicking into the subtext of the film, which is what you hope. So far so good.
So you're Australian, and you mentioned that the Caesar is a great drink, but of course when one thinks of Aussie drinking culture, they think of beer. So what is your favorite beer? It could be Australian, could be Canadian. Do you have one that you tend to go towards?
Look, it just depends on the temperature. And I'm not really a beer drinker, but if I'm hot and bothered, for example, I've been... Are you Celsius or Fahrenheit?
We use Celsius.
Celsius. So I've been mowing the lawns on a 40-degree day, all right? At the end of that, we say, yeah, you're feeling a little bit hot and bothered. I'll reach for a can of Melbourne Bitter.
All right.
And shortly after that, I only ever have one or two beers. And then, you know, something more interesting after that, usually.
I know people often get Australians and Kiwis confused a lot.
Yeah.
What would you say is the biggest difference, or and maybe the most common things people confuse about those two countries and those two cultures?
Well, look, they're very similar in many ways. I couldn't really say the accent's very different, and it's kind of a relationship, a very close relationship, where you end up making a lot of fun of each other, probably like you guys and the Americans, right?
Yeah, or us and the British even.
Right. Yeah. So there's a lot of animosity. They're very good at rugby. Very good at rugby.
Yeah.
Like, they smash us every time we play them.
Speaking of rugby, rugby, Aussie rules, or football?
Oh, Aussie rules.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I think people don't necessarily understand exactly what Aussie rules is. How different is it than rugby, would you say?
Oh, completely different. Yeah? Yeah. Well, for a start, it's played on an oval field, not a square.
Okay.
It's not stop and start. It's a very fluid game. In a way, it's something you have to be born into.
Right.
I mean, I adore it.
And then there's Aussie rules, and then there's rugby league, right?
Yeah. So Aussie rules is predominantly played in Western Australia, South Australia, Tasmania and Victoria, and Queensland and New South Wales play rugby,
right?
More or less.
You mentioned that New Zealand can beat you guys at rugby, but who's got the better cricket team?
At the moment, they do.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because we're cheats.
Oh, really?
It's a long story.
Yeah. Well, I think I heard something about a recent cricket scandal that was kind of bizarre, because of all the sports you think of cheating in, like, cricket is not the top of anyone's list.
There's hundreds of thousands of Australian fathers having to explain to their, you know, 8, 9, 10-year-old sons and daughters what's just happened, you know,
yeah.
Like when they were caught cheating.
Yeah.
And so stupid. They were just so stupid. Okay, cheating one thing, getting caught's another one, but getting caught when it's just so incredibly stupid, that's something entirely different.
Yeah. What do you think is the overall biggest misconceptions about Australians?
Look, from a Canadian perspective, I sort of don't really know. I know that when I'm in the States, I'm sort of I'm constantly surprised how unaware they are of, you know, they've got very broad brushstroke kind of notions of Australia, like g'day mate and
shrimp on the
barbie and kind of like 30-year-old advertising campaigns. Paul Hogan.
Yeah.
Kangaroos, crocodiles, things that probably the overall conception is people think that you're lucky to get through a day without being killed by something poisonous or deadly.
Dingoes, yeah.
Or dingoes or something like that.
Obviously, the Duke and Duchess just had a new baby, and we're both Canada and Australia are members of the Commonwealth, and technically British subjects, and I know there was, Canada's sort of indifferent, and I know there's a big movement in Australia to become a republic. Where's your stance? Do you think we'll see that any time in the future?
Oh, look, ultimately Australia's a very conservative country, in my opinion. Having said that, just last year, gay marriage was
legalized.
Was legalized. There was a plebiscite, and you know, so people kind of want modernization. They want change. And the fact that we're in the 21st century, and that the royal family of another country is our titular head of state, strikes me as just very immature, you know. So many countries have to spill blood for their independence, and all we need to do is have a referendum. But, you know, Yeah, strangely, I know a lot of Indigenous Australians would be really against it because, in a counterintuitive way, you think the Crown being responsible for so much misery.
Yeah.
But she's that old lady on the money, and she's been here, you know, for a long time, and she's all right. You know, strong family history. They really relate to that.
Yeah. What do you want, ultimately, people to come away with when they see this film?
Well, for the large part, Indigenous culture in Australia has been presented in the last 50 years as an amalgamation of problems, of issues that are largely without a solution. So it's kind of looked at as a problem. Our film doesn't do that. It looks at the incredible aspects of their culture, and it really celebrates those. And to think that some of these songs that Gurung was singing are, you know, thought to be 10, 20,000 years old, that makes them the oldest human constructs in existence, apart from some rock paintings. So, you know, that sense of wonder that I have when I'm kind of out there spending time with these people, I really hope that audiences take that away with them. And they are. In Australia, they are. That's the feeling. And also to tap into that that deep emotionality that is his music.
Well, the film is Gourmet, and it's going to be playing here at Hot Docs in Toronto. Paul Damien Williams, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, yeah.
That was my conversation with Paul David Williams. His film Gourmet is playing at Hot Docs this week. Christoph Schlingensief was a German writer, director, theater artist, performance artist, and all-around provocateur. As I mentioned in the interview, I think the only person in North America who has done anything that comes close to Schlingensief in the past is John Waters, but even their films are very, very different. The Goethe Institute here in Toronto is holding a three-day or three-night event, retrospective, if you want, of Schlingensief films. There's 120 Days of Buttrop, The German Chainsaw Massacre, and then Holding Skulls is Not My Thing, which is a phone interview between him and the director, Alexander Klug. He is a very, very fascinating person, artist, that tragically died just before hitting 50 of lung cancer. And he was very influenced by people like Fassbinder. We get into Herzog. We get into a lot of other, you know, a lot of underground, the underground German cinema movement that arose after the fall of Nazism and the recovery of that in the 60s and 70s. And so although Schlingensief died in 2010, the retrospective will be hosted by Toronto filmmaker Bruce LaBruce. And as I mentioned, the Goethe Institute here in Toronto is putting it on, and I got to speak with the curator of that institute earlier today, Jutta Brendemühl. So this is me and Jutta talking about the late, great Christoph Schlingensief. Here we go.
Jutta Brendemühl, hello.
Hi, Dan. Danke. How are you?
Good to meet you. So you are the curator here at the Goethe Institute, and you guys are curating, a retrospective, can we call it that, of Christoph Schlingensief?
I wonder whether that is even possible to do a retro of Christoph Schlingensief. Yeah, it's a It's a small series of two of his later features and then two contextualizing documentaries.
Mm-hmm. Approach Those You Fear. And I think, you know, if you're not a film expert or you're not a film historian, he might not be a name that you recognize as much as somebody like, you know, Wim Wenders or Herzog or Rainer Werner Fassbinder. What was it about Schlickensief that you wanted to, that you wanted the world and you wanted Canada to see?
Yeah, very good point. Exactly. He's not a household name. He is known, was known. He died in 2010, unfortunately. He is and was known in Germany, and he has a particular niche in German film history. I think it was more his... it was really the content matter that grabbed me, where I thought, oh my God, it's all already there. What we're experiencing in the world right now, populism, the curtailment of freedoms, the demise of democratic civil societies, xenophobia. Christoph Schlingensief, as an artist, and he was very much a Gesamtkunstwerk, he literally worked in every imaginable genre, but mainly as a filmmaker. He all saw it coming our way in the 90s. You know, everybody thought he was the crazy guy. He is an enfant terrible. He was very wild, highly intellectual as well. But, you know, it's easy to say, oh, he's just crazy. And that was a lot of the criticism that was leveled at him. And then, you know, 10, 20 years later, we're like, oh, no, he wasn't crazy. You know, the others were crazy. So it's one of those situations where I felt like I nearly had to rediscover him. I was around him quite a bit in the 90s in Berlin when he was doing a lot of performance work. And then I do remember the early 2000s when he knew he was dying of cancer. And he did a huge piece about that. And it was really... and then he kind of went away. He's not so much in the canon, certainly not like the Fassbinders and the Herzogs and the Wendersers. The funny thing is, and that's why I start with the film 100 Days of Bottrop, because he goes through all of these guys and he kills his darlings, right? Yeah. And he does reference being influenced by mostly Buñuel, but also very strongly by Fassbinder. He does not appreciate Wim Wenders very much and has stories about that as well. And that's all good, but he's equal opportunities extreme and rude, including to himself.
I can definitely see the influence of Buñuel in his films, which may surprise a lot of people. But for 120 Days of Bottrop, which I got to see, what do you think I sort of love how we called it an homage to Fassbinder, but that the opening says that Fassbinder would never make never make this film. What do you think he was trying to say about film, about the world with that piece of art?
If you know film history a bit, there's interesting sort of references. Also, by the way, if you don't know film history, you can watch this film as just an incredible, crazy romp about the art of filmmaking and enjoy all the cameos of everybody's that in it. Because he has half of the Fassbinder crew in there. Im Hermann is in there, one of the famous actresses. You'll recognize her face immediately. Udo Kier, he's worked so much with Udo Kier, he's in it. Roland Emmerich, you know, the guy who made Independence Day is in it.
That was a hilarious cameo,
I must say. Right? It was so, and Roland Emmerich keeps cracking up in the film, right? He can't keep his face straight. But apart from that, there is a history to that question of why he references sort of Fassbinder and goes after Wenders. Funnily enough, he was born in the town of Oberhausen, and Oberhausen has gone down in film history because it has a fantastic festival, of course, experimental festival that was founded in the 60s. And also in that time, those guys, the Herzogs and Fassbinders, got together to create new German film, right, in the 60s and 70s. And Schlingensief, half jokingly says, I'm making the last new German film. I think he just thought really it was time for something new. He was not accepted into the Film Academy in Munich, although at that point in time when he was 20, he had screened in Oberhausen. You know, some people never get to screen at the Oberhausen Festival. He had several of his works as a teenager on German public television. But he wasn't accepted into the academies. And he I think it was sort of one of those, the king is dead, long live the king. He just wanted to sort of have another Oberhausen, movement, where he said, we got to do it completely differently. We got to revolutionize. We got to foster independent cinema, which is very much is, you know. So indie cinema, genre cinema, right? He plays with genre, with splatter films, with Chainsaw Massacre, and kind of takes it down and then rebuilds it into something shiny and new.
How would you describe new German cinema? Is it something to do with maybe the aesthetics of the film and the type of film? I think for me the parallel that I see is maybe with the French new wave of this, you know, the 60s and 70s, like you know, Truffaut and Godot, people like that. How would you describe sort of the ideals of the new German cinematic movement?
Mm-hmm. Well, it came out of European post-war history, I guess, and, you know, they'd really just gotten to the point where they've had enough of, well, and also in Germany, there was a huge break, of course, in Nazism in our film history, which, interestingly enough, particularly in this film, in this first film we're showing, Schlingensief picks up because he has Leni Riefenstahl, you know, Hitler's DOP, as a character and as his DOP of his film in the film. So he again references that, and there was this huge break in German film history. Like, it can't be overstated how I feel it as a film, as a programmer of German and European films, nearly daily, what that has done and how detrimental that was for decades to come. So come the 60s and 70s and the Nouvelle Vague and new German cinema, it was just kind of their idea of, we're going to do something completely different, we're going to be independent, we're going to look at different social classes that had been portrayed before. You know, Wenders went to the US to do road movies. Again, a genre, right? That wasn't being done in Germany before. But then again, what did Christoph Schlingensief add? He was way more political than all of them put together. And I'm not saying that they weren't political. They were certainly political through just the act of filmmaking. And, you know, if you look at some of the Fassbinder films, Fury to Soul, Angst essen Seele auf, again, like a prescient film about xenophobia and racism, of course. But Schlingensief was all activism. This was activist cinema, maybe for the first time, where it wasn't just about the art making, but the art making was always a political act. And he references Beuys, Joseph Beuys, the artist, more so maybe than he references film history. Yeah.
On that note, you know, he was known for staging public controversies, I think, is how it was termed. In German culture and in German art, what do you think it means to be a provocateur?
Oh, that is such an interesting question. We actually have, there's a word in the German language that is really hard to translate, and it, you know, probably for good reason, because it is so specifically culturally German. It's called Streitkultur. So that means sort of the culture of antagonism and fighting it out. So that already is a trademark sort of in German cultural production. And again, I referenced Beuys, who was a highly political artist to the point where he was a member of the Green Party, co-founder of the Green Party. And Schlingensief also sort of embodied that. So in a way, it's nearly expected. And he's playing with it, right? So it's being an agent provocateur, an iconoclast, is something that, yeah, you might roll your eyes at, but secretly you admire it and you request it nearly from art making. So it's not that it came out of the blue. It was just, I think, also the historic time in that he lived, and a lot of films were showing are around German reunification. So this was, again, a mega shift in Europe, right? And he recognized it, well, as it happened. The other film was showing the German Chainsaw Massacre, you know, his take on a Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but also on reunification. He did it within sort of months of, you know, weeks, actually shot it in 2 weeks around the time of reunification and just threw it out there in the cinemas because he had this urge to immediately comment And it was, yeah, it was met. It was extremely controversial. I mean, it has cannibalism. That's why the series, other than it already is 18 plus, like all of our series, I felt the need to slap on another, you know, viewer discretion is advised, which I never do on top of the 18 plus. But this does necessitate it in a way. So the provocation is something, yes, that German culture, and that extends to Austria as well, and we'll get to that maybe in a moment, also expects and toys with. And yeah, I'm referencing Austria just because he did this particular project that was a performance project, but that got captured in a beautiful documentary called Foreigners Out, Schlingensief's Container. So Foreigners Out was the brutal name of the project, and basically he set up a Big Brother container and in the middle of Vienna, downtown Vienna, as part of a theater festival, and people every night could vote out asylum seekers to be deported from Europe, which was just, you know, a commentary on, of course, the right-wing politics and the right-wing, extreme right-wing government in Austria at the time, the first one after, I think the first one in Europe after after World War II. So complete breaking of taboos, right? Like fascism was no, out. And here we are, and, you know, a Western European country elects a far right, let's say, government. So here was Schlingensief immediately recognizing what that meant historically. And also at the same time going for, that was his other big field of criticism, he was very astute at immediately recognizing new media movements. And what, like, he had antenna. It was amazing. Like, I called him an ogre, I think, an ogre and an oracle in my curatorial write-up. Because he saw things coming. Like, he coined a phrase in the 90s. He called it me TV, when everybody else was still talking about reality TV. But, of course, The Bachelor is not reality TV, right? And we're still watching this stuff. What it is me TV. It's me. And this was before anybody had a cell phone and was taking selfies. He already saw it, and it was coming.
I actually found 120 Days quite hilarious because of the absurdity of the situations that a lot of the characters were in. And I think, at least here in North America, there's a stereotype that Germans have a very dark sense of humor. I think is that a misconception about Germany, or do you think that there is a certain underappreciated comedic timing to come out of that part of the world?
Oh, I'm so glad you're asking that, because of course mostly we get, oh, Germans have no sense of humor. So you at least think there's a perception of sort of a dark humor. Not so sure that many people would see it that way, but Schlingensief is one of those where there's hilarious moments, and some of them are intentional, and some of them happen in these happenings. For example, there's an unbelievably funny moment too in Foreigners Out, this documentary, where an old Austrian lady comes up, and she's in the middle of this tirade against him, and, you know, Austria has to be Austrian and out with everybody else, and then she hits him on the head, I think with a bottle, because of Schlingensief, he was always there, of course, in this container, so she hits him on the head, and she screams and yells, and she says, also another little sort of internal European clash between Austrians and Germans, he is also the German theater maker, artist, who comes in and criticizes Austria, how dare he, so she says, "You dirty crowd," and then she tops it by saying, you artist. And everybody laughs. Like, everybody, you know, passers-by laugh, the artists laugh, the asylum seekers, their actors laugh. And that's one of those brilliant moments that Schlingensief loves, but of course he can't script them. In 120 Days of Bottrop, he does script them, and it's funny, but it's always, yes, it is darkly funny. That's true. You know what? I don't know. I wonder whether you felt the same way about that moment where, I think we can say that even here, again, viewer discretion and hearer discretion advised, there's a scene where a producer, the producer of the film in the film, gets...
Volker.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Volker Spengler, Fassbinder actor, famous Fassbinder actor, in this role, gets a blowjob from an extra. And Im Hermann, the famous Fassbinder actress, who's the star of this film. And the film walks in and says, "Oh, I should have known. Some things just never change." And, you know, I'm sitting here, I rewatched them. I'd seen the film before, of course, but I rewatched it as I was curating it. And this was the height of Me Too and Time's Up and everything. And I'm like, oh my God, this is Weinstein. This is Weinstein life. And, you know, he showed it decades before and commented on it. And everybody, you know, was disgusted that he would show such a scene. But I always say people who level that criticism at him, that he's extreme, that it's not tasteful. I'm just like, no, he's not insane. What's insane is what he's revealing and what he's showing. And he's so radical about it. Like, you can't escape the images. You know, it's not a nice scene. You know, I was sitting at home, I was going, ooh, I'd forgotten about that scene. But it's a very meaningful, very powerful scene. You know, he describes quite literally, there's like placards out on Potsdamer Platz where he's, you know, they're filming and there's a sign that says Sodom, and it refers to the studio system. He refers to the cinema studio system as Sodom, and God knows, since last year, we all know that it has always been that.
I think it was struck when I was watching the film that the one North American filmmaker that I could think of that would dare do something like this is John Waters.
Huh.
Who, you know, was very agent provocateur in the 70s and late 60s, you know, 70s, 80s, and even up to the 90s. And I'm curious if, A, you would either do it, you know, maybe do a Waters film next to a Schlingensee film, but also if you see any maybe similarities today with German filmmakers and North American filmmakers.
That's a hard one. I mean, Schlingensief, I think, was fairly unique. So there's, you know, he's not part of that school. Well, also, of course, Fassbinder is nothing like Herzog, is nothing like Wenders, is nothing like von Trotter. They still came out of the same system. You can see references in their aesthetics. Christoph Schlingensief, also, he said he was influenced by Nickus, who was an experimental, not that well-known, internationally not that well-known, but very influential filmmaker. But, for example, I can't think of anybody past him. That's an interesting question. I wonder whether, no, maybe somebody in inside genre film. But then you often just get the genre without the political subject matter, right? And if in a short form, I always talk about the series as political splatter.
Right.
You know, it's a very short form for what this is, because it marries sort of art and the love, art house, and the love of genre. There is a scene in Foreigners Out, the documentary, where, oh my God, who was it? And I probably shouldn't, even if I remember now, there is an American filmmaker who shows up at the Container, because now word has gotten around. By the way, you know, politicians show up and other artists show up, and they kind of want to be seen with Schlingensief. They want to have a piece of the action. And then, you know, he makes this impassioned speech that we should have this project in New York and Washington and Boston. We should all do Foreigners Out and do this reality format of voting Foreigners Out. And then it cuts to Schlingensief being interviewed about this sort of intervention of this American filmmaker, indie filmmaker. And he smiles, and he can be pretty rough. And he smiles and he says, yeah, it's nice that he came, but he didn't do it. He then didn't go on. So there's a lot of talk, and then hardly anybody walks the walk, and he always did, right? And really, he has no heir, I think. I can't think of anybody quite yet. There's still a few sort of radicals. There's a bit of a sort of a lo-fi film movement in Germany. I'm not super impressed with a lot of what comes out of that right now, because it is very tame. It is I'm quite certain Schlingensief would have hated it. It is, other than that, it pretends to be sort of low budget, lo-fi, you know, shaky cell phone camera. It is very touchy, feely, straight narrative. There's not a lot of innovation.
There's actually,
I don't know, I can't answer the question.
There was a great line in the film from Udo Kier, where he's on the phone and he says, oh, 7 million? You can't make anything for that in the U.S., but you can make you know, 7 films for that in Germany.
Yeah.
And what do you think that says just about the approach to filmmaking, you know, in North America versus in Europe, where I find that in Europe they're much more attuned with, you know, like story and character, where over here it's more just about spectacle, spectacle, spectacle.
Yeah, you know, and big name casting, and maybe we're back with the problem of the studio system, which we don't have to such a degree. Of course, we have big producers in Germany, and we have literally one gigantic studio, and that's UFA, which has been there since, you know, since Fritz Lang's times, and muddled its way through Nazism and muddled its way through the GDR, and is now, again, a fairly influential studio that does a lot of TV and a lot of foreign productions. But overall, yeah, maybe you're right that at least there's a lot more focus, I believe, on what do you want to call it, worthwhile or good content in the funding system. Now, there's a lot of criticism being leveled at the German funding system from within, but, you know, boy, it works. Like, I'm just sitting, again, in Hot Dogs Festival or TIFF and wherever I go. Oh my God, it feels like nearly every second film, art house film produced on the planet, whether documentary or feature, has some German funding, right? There's regional funding, so that already makes it like more than a dozen funders, and then there's federal funding, and then there's the TV stations that also commission more than here, I would dare to say. Notwithstanding, of course, what's happening right now with Netflix, Amazon, and all those platforms, and we'll see how that goes. But they also go for very heavily for the famous original content that everybody looks for, but they're going to Europe, and I'm really surprised. There's a huge focus of Amazon, Netflix, some of even the smaller platforms below that focus on Germany. Like, there's, I think, 6 or 7 original content productions in the German language right now that are being marketed globally. What it will mean for film is, at this point, anybody's guess. I mean, it's not the end of cinema and not the end of film, but I think it will dramatically change where the money will go and for what the money will go.
Yeah. We talked about... you know, you talk about refugees and just how Schlickensief went after politics and politicians. But do you think film and art itself is inherently political? Because no matter who you are making a statement with what you say and what you do.
Yeah, is that already politics? Or is that is that you? And, you know, and maybe that probably has to do with a bit of a different... interpretation of what politics means in Europe, or used to mean in Europe, versus in North America, where it would also always mean a bigger group, a larger social impact. Again, probably Schlingensief would go back to Beuys, who famously said, and a lot of people misunderstand it at a very, very basic level, but that we're all artists. You know, that's the idea, that every expression is also an expression of our voice and our political views. Now, Schlingensief wasn't doing party politics either. You know, I mean, we can all guess where he was standing, but in his film, none of it is party politics. Even in that second feature that we're showing, the German Chainsaw Massacre, which is a commentary on the time of German reunification and what was bought and sold, and he certainly always tackles the market, the hyper neoliberal market, as a dangerous thing. But it's not party politics. I would say, though, that, yeah, he is a good example of definitely where the art cannot be separated from the politics, or he wouldn't want to have done that, or the politics from the art. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it comes very much through his strong personality. Like, it's always very self-referential. Like, he is always... Sometimes he is in the works being played by an actor. For example, in 120 Days of Butter, which is hilarious. Or he plays an assistant to the actor who plays him, or another famous director. So it's this constant merry-go-round of passing on authorship as well. But it's always in a larger context, in a larger group context.
One note that I made that was the idea of aesthetics versus intellect, because I find when I watch big budget, there are exceptions to the rule, but when I find, you know, when I watch like big, you know, like $200 million movies, it's just a whole bunch of action and not else. And I think the smaller you get, and oftentimes I see this in European cinema, the smarter the film is, the smarter the story is. Do you find that at all, that there's a certain marriage of not only the style of the film and the look of the film, but also the smartness and the intelligence of the story or the characters within that film?
I'm sure we could both find examples for that, right? But I wonder whether it has to be that way. And then, you know, just thinking of something like Black Panther, whether that would refute that idea these days. I think it's just, in a way, two completely different kettles of fish. And that's maybe why you got Roland Emmerich in, right? Roland Emmerich, which, you know, we're so proud of him. He's that German guy who made Independence Day and all these other big, speaking of explosions, you know, he's the guy you call for explosions. And of course, Schlingensief references that in his own work. But maybe 100 Days of Bottrop is an interesting example of where he plays with what you're just asking, where, you know, again, like it is a fairly low budget film. Of course, it's not an American film. Udo Kier is right when he's trying to get money for the film on the phone there in the film. But on the other hand, there is, it's always like high and low is always in one intertwined in Schlingensief's work. If you read the credits and you know your art house world really, really well, you will see that the film, I was surprised to see it, was edited by Bettina Bürlavich. She is the editor of Christian Petzold, for starters. She recently edited Valeska Griesebach's mega hit Western. She edited Nicolette Krebitz's Wild, which played Sundance 2-3 years ago. She edited Margarete von Trotta's famous 2012 film Hannah Arendt. So she's like she's the goddess of German arthouse editing. She edited this film, you know, which probably people who come in from a genre perspective would not have noticed. Like, you wouldn't go around, you know, it's like a lot of wobbly camera. They're all traipsing around Berlin as it was just being sort of still rebuilt in a way. It certainly doesn't look nothing like a Petzold film or a Valeska Griesebach film, yet he's very particular about the art in it. And maybe that's where German and European cinema can be really great, because they manage to marry it. And I can't come up with that many American examples that can pull off both. Where you'd say, this is an amazingly made art house film. And, you know, I say that as a big fan, for example, of Die Hard. Love Die Hard. Nearly all of them. But would they win, you know, best editor?
I think the closest thing I can think of recently is probably something like Moonlight. Maybe.
Yeah. No, that's very true. Yeah. I think, exactly, maybe more recently we will find more examples, because... Oh, I'm always an optimist. So what I just referenced with sort of, you know, Netflix, Amazon, and VOD. Yeah. What I hope will happen is actually that, you know, as it is more audience-targeted or audience-driven, that they'll just have to up their game in terms of what they deliver. You know, you just can't turn out plonk anymore, because it'll go away. It'll go away in season one. I mean, things are now being cut within the first season, so the stakes are so high, and people are producing really great quality content. Another example is actually, and speaking of genre, you asked me that, I still think about your question about the dark humor and genre. There is a director, Barenboim Odar, who was a TIFF twice already with his first big feature film, Who Am I?, which was a hacker thriller. I showed it in our Goethe film series afterwards, and people loved it again. And then he was back last year with at TIFF Prime with Dark. And it was a huge success. It's a, I think it's the first Netflix, if it's not the first Netflix, the first Amazon. No, it's the first Netflix, German Netflix show. Brilliant show. It is kind of near future sci-fi, sort of a bit dark and spiritual. And he is really and absolutely well produced and like high quality.
Yeah.
Got great reviews in Europe and here, which doesn't always happen. Sometimes, you know, really the tastes are completely divergent. I just saw it at the Berlinale a couple of months ago where, you know, you'd look at the critics' grid and it would be diametrically opposed in the American media and the German media. Yeah, maybe guys like Baum Beodar, a bit, you know, way more slick, way more, but they're picking up genre, they're not afraid, and they're gutsy, and they say, no, I'm making good quality work, and it might be a thriller, and it might be horror. Horror is having a bit of a renaissance in Germany as well, after decades. Oh, maybe those are the guys that are the heirs to Christoph Schlimm's either way.
Horror always has a way of being on the forefront of, I think, political thought or certain, you know, certain ideas, I find.
Yeah.
And we're seeing a renaissance.
Get out.
I think of. Finally, we talked a little bit about, you know, politics, and there's, you know, a lot of comedians and political satirists over here always joke that right now Germany is keeping Europe sane and together. I'm curious as to whether you think, you know, it's John Stewart a number of years ago, he says, wait, we're relying on Germany to save us 60 years after World War II and Germany
not
controls the fate of Europe. But I'm curious as to whether you think, you know, the current political situation with the refugees and everything that's happening over there, how you think that might affect German cinema going forward, if at all.
It will affect it. It is affecting it. I've seen it over the last few years already, and not that this started over the last few years, but you know, there's the famous or infamous summer of 2015 with that huge wave of refugees who came across the Mediterranean because of Syria and all of that, and the you know, 1.2, 1.5 million people came, and most of them went to Germany. And just I think 6 months later, I managed to pull together a film program around that, called A Long Way, Europe Between Fortress and Refuge. And I think that's still largely the question. And I was surprised that I could, in a way, pull it off so quickly because, you know, films have to be produced first. It's not like a newspaper report that you can get out the next day or a TV documentary. You need time to reflect. Filmmakers need time to reflect. And then, of course, after we really saw it, when a documentary about the refugee crisis won the Berlinale Golden Bear the next year, and this continued. As I said, I'm just back from the Berlinale, so to speak, and I'm very certain at TIFF we will see Christian Petzold's new work called Transit, which is a brilliant film, a really, really great film. That takes a piece of literature by Anna Seghers set in 1942 in Marseille. So we are talking Nazism and refugees trying to get away, trying to get out of the country, trying to get to the U.S., maybe at this point ironically, or Mexico. And he took it as a metaphor and has very cleverly not sort of equated it with the refugee situation in Europe right now, but has, I think, come up with a really wonderful commentary about, yeah, human suffering, making decisions about your life, and you have no idea what's going to happen the next day. It seems that those films are getting more subtle, so it certainly impacts people like Christian Petzold, who've never been that. It's not that he's not making political films, but he's not like a political activist kind of guy who does party politic cinema. Of course not. It's getting more subtle, I think, with more reflection. It is noticeable. I mean, just the numbers, right? Another documentary that was lauded in Berlin this year was El Dorado, and another one won the documentary award. In a way, a follow-up or a prequel to the Austrian documentary that we have in here is by an Austrian filmmaker about Waldheim, who was a Nazi and then became, in the 80s, became president of Austria, and huge outcry happened, but we've forgotten about this. So the stories have always been there. It's just that they're coming together. It's like a tornado, maybe. What is the long-term impact? I mean, it's going to be huge either way, but what it will be and whether there will be a whole genre. There already is a bit of a genre of what's called sort of migration movies, migration films, which is a larger picture than sort of refugee films. We'll see. Go watch Christian Petzold's Transit. This is my bet on tape when it comes to TIFF 18, I hope.
Well, the Schlegensief retrospective goes up May 10.
Yes, that is right. Three nights, May 10, 15, and 17. We're at the TIFF Bell Lightbox starting with 120 Days of Bottrop. Oh my God, and I should say I'm so excited about that. It was more sort of gut feeling through the style of it. And I approached Bruce LaBruce, who, is a Canadian filmmaker, of course, but nearly an honorary German because he spends so much time at the Berlinale and produces some of his films in Germany. And also I just felt that he would be a guy who could appreciate Schlingensief's work. And so Bruce is going to introduce the film, mostly, 120 Days of Bottrop, and comment on the filmmaking, the film in the film. And then, as I said, Foreigners Out is that documentary about Schlingensief's container with good laughs and physical brawls. So you have to be ready for both. And then, while we're closing with the German Chainsaw Massacre, that really is something. The first hour of reunification, where people get turned into sausages. And it's just followed, if you then want to stay, it's a double bill in one sitting, by an interview documentary between Alexander Kluge, who in himself has become sort of an idol of German filmmaking and German thinking, talking to Christoph Schlingensief. It's funny on two, well, it's interesting on two levels. A, you learn a lot about Christoph Schlingensief's thinking. He talks about a Hamlet production that he did in which he played Fortinbras, but also cast neo-Nazis, or sort of neo-Nazis that were about to maybe leave the scene. And he was, of course, heavily criticized. Also, this was in Zurich, in Switzerland. That didn't, again, make it better that this is German artist coming in and using neo-Nazis on stage. But he explains quite beautifully what he wanted to do. He once said, we should all put that on our Twitter accounts these days, you got to get extremists in, not out. Yeah. That's very much his approach. And we're closing with that. It is a fairly short but also interesting piece because both Kluge and Schlingensief were Kluge still alive, highly intellectual, and they think faster than they can talk, so they're talking very fast and a lot over each other. But it's still, you still walk away thinking like, oh my God, that's a great point. My favorite maybe in it is when Schlingensief talks about humanism and barbarianism, and that's my bottom line. That's why I want to, my fiendish plan is that's why I want to show this series, because he was a humanist, he's deeply humanist. Deeply humanist because he cares about people. Christoph Schlingensief cared about humanity. That's why he made these films, right? And he wasn't afraid of tackling barbarians.
Well, Schlingensief's Approach to Those You Fear, May 10th, 15th, and 17th at the TIFF Bell Light Docs. Youth of Brindamil, thanks so much.
Thank you, Dan. See you there.
That was my conversation with Youth Brindamil. And the retrospective on Schlingensief, Approach Those You Fear, is May 10th, 15th and 17th at the TIFF Bell Lightbox. That does it for me today. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.